Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 20th, 2013. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I am Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And I am very happy. I don't know if you were as happy as I am, but I was so happy to, at 2 a.m., be perusing the IMDb app to find out that, indeed, Rounders 2 is moving forward.
Yes, it's been they've been teasing us for, like, what, 20, 30 years or
yeah,
so?
Yeah, I think it is 30 years.
Or no, that was Cincinnati Kids sequel. I'm still waiting for but no, they've been teasing us forever, right? And as close to as official as we can get, Harvey Weinstein from the Weinstein Brothers, who brought us the first one, finally told some trade magazine that the movie will be, quote, instantaneous.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. Some of the headlines were green lighting, which I know the Hollywood lingo for that.
Yeah.
But I don't know why he wouldn't just say, it's been green lighted.
Instantaneous.
Instantaneous. Is it going straight to video? That's what made me think. But it seems to be moving forward, and they've given us a couple details. Matt Damon and Ed Norton will be back, as Mike and Worm. John Malkovich will not be back. At least it doesn't sound like he will be.
Mm-hmm.
But he's looking to cast Robert De Niro as the poker villain.
Very interesting.
And it will start with a card game in Paris. Probably just because they wanted to go to Paris, right? There's no real reason otherwise. And then it will end in Vegas. But that's all we know right now. Enough to get us all excited, isn't it?
I could just see De Niro now. You're betting into me? You're betting into me. I don't see anybody else sitting over here. You're betting into me? But, you know, I think I like my sequel better, where the judge's wife dies. And
yes, I know you do.
So,
you.
But yeah. It sounds interesting. In Paris, I'm assuming that Ed Norton's character, Worm, will somehow get there and, you know, pull some tricks, and Damon and him will have to get back together again for something. And maybe they'll be rivals, too. Who knows? But it sounds like he really wants De Niro to be the foil in this, so... Very cool. And they're making it international, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it very well could be that Worm is just in the Vegas part of it, you know, where he has to come in to save Mike this time.
Yes.
Mike saved him last time.
Yeah, oh, they call that turning the tables.
Yes.
And it could very well introduce some sort of online thing, too, since it's international. They could be over there doing something, and then who knows. But they talked about it being a card room in Paris or something, so.
Yeah.
Very exciting. So, and a Good Will Hunting series, by the way, which sounds...
Oh, yeah.
Terrible, but I don't know.
I didn't really see why we need another one of those. The first one was great, don't get me wrong.
But a series?
Like, me.
That doesn't make sense.
All right, that was a perfect ending. The guy gets in the crappy-ass car and drives out to get Mini Driver. Well, you can ruin that.
Now
these Rounders were like, hey, he got in a crappy little cab. He was going to the World Series. So, yeah, I want to know what happened to him now.
Yeah, you know, that's two movies where he gets into a car and heads out to the West Coast. And we don't know
that's
what he's really
thing,
doing.
I think.
Or the West. But really cool, very excited, can't wait for that.
All right, well, this next story, I've kind of resisted putting it on the notes, Chris, for a couple of weeks. Because the initial story was in the New York Post, which I don't believe any word I read in the New York Post.
That's true.
But then it got picked up by a couple of poker websites, which means that they just picked up somebody else's work and posted it as their own.
Yep.
So that doesn't help me at all.
Right.
Now, finally, kind of one of the alternative newspapers in South Florida posted a story and actually talked to it. So I'm willing to give it a little bit of credence to the point that I'm going to bring it up on the show now. I'm still not sold, though. All right, I'm skeptical. I don't know if you saw this thing that was going around, but it was extremely hilarious. It was on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter. You're on Twitter, so maybe you did see it. This guy who got into a war with this woman on the plane, and they were exchanging nasty notes back and forth each other because he didn't like how he was treating the flight attendants, and ended up getting into a fight in the terminal after the flight. hilarious. And I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. And that never happens to me.
Okay.
I'm always the one on Facebook going, hey, guys, does that sound like it could be true? It's not. It doesn't sound like it could be true. It's probably not. And I fell for it this time, so I'm hoping I'm not falling for this one. But it's just such an amazing story that even if it's fake, it's fun to talk about.
Okay.
All right, so here's what happened. This poker pro in our home state here in Florida, Eric Riley, was up in Atlantic City and had a pretty, pretty good day at the tables. And was carrying 100,000 G's in his backpack.
100,000 G's or $100,000? Because 100,000 G's would be like way more than $100,000.
Sounds better that way, right? If we're making up the story, let's make it bigger. $100,000.
Yeah, $100,000.
In a backpack like we all do all right. the time.
Right? Yeah.
And so he was going to catch a cab to JFK to fly home. And this guy that's been railing him all week said, no, hey, man, I got a car. We'll take you. He's like, all right. Gets to the airport, gets out. Guy pops the trunk, he goes in and reach it, and the car, boom, speeds away.
Oh, man.
With the backpack, with the 100,000. So, the pro, as the story goes, hops into a cab, throws like $400 at him, and he says, follow that car! Never like, it's like a TV show.
Like right? in the movies, yeah.
Exactly. So the guy takes chase. Of course, it's New York City, so massive traffic. So the pro jumps out at one point. The trunk is still open, so he reaches in the trunk, gets the money, and rolls over on the ground, you know, dramatic fashion. The car speeds off. And then, this other car shows up. Two guys get out and say, hey, we're undercover cops. We've been following this. What's going on? Get in the car. We'll try to find this guy. And the guy goes, that sounds completely believable. I'm going to jump in the car. And he gets in the car, and then apparently one of the guys pulls a gun off.
Oh,
guess
man.
What? Not an undercover cop.
Undercover cops.
So then the guy's like, you know, all the MacGyver and stuff, and he's like, you know, I'm not going to stay here and get shot. So he popped the door open and rolled out onto the ground again and escaped, and the car took off. Eventually, he had to flag down another cab, got to law enforcement. Now law enforcement is investigating it, but the dude still got his 100,000, lost a bunch of other stuff. But that's the story. Do you believe it?
Hey, it was on the interwebs. I believe anything on the interwebs. The NEL PokerCast is strictly entertainment. It's not to be taken for news value. No, I mean, what the hell? I mean, is this guy like the other guy who was saying that he was a dolphin trainer? I mean, you know, and he's looking for some attention? Or did it really
it's
happen?
It's a much better story than a dolphin trainer.
It is much better than a dolphin trainer. Absolutely. That was involving just Photoshop and a lie. This is pretty exciting stuff here. So... I don't know. I mean, the undercover cop part is kind of bizarre. Like, these guys are following these, like,
yeah,
hey, look at that.
Lost me.
We might get $100,000 out of this. Let's follow them. You know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, I guess supposedly the first guy and the quote-unquote undercover cops are working together. So that kind of makes sense. But to me, it's just gets out of the car, and then this car with two random dudes shows up, and, hey, hop in. Sure.
Well, here,
that's where the story lost me.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is if they're working together, why do they have to go through the whole ruse of, we're undercover cops? No, hey, here's the gun. Give me the cash. I mean, it's not like they need to protect, you know, just shoot them or give me, you know, whatever. It makes no sense. So, yeah, it could have happened. I'm not going to say this guy didn't. You said South Florida paper picked it up and then talked to him and whatever. That still doesn't mean it's
they
true.
They were kind of cagey on talking to him. It was it's the Miami New Times. If folks want to check out that story, and search for Eric Riley, and you'll see it. But it wasn't that. Hey, let's talk to Eric Riley about this dramatic thing. It was like quoting some guy from Poker News about why poker players carry this much money with them.
Yeah.
So it was a very well written story, but it was almost as if they're like, hey, we need to write this, and we don't believe it any more than Scott Long does, but we're going to make it a real story, even if it's not. So I'll give him credit for that,
maybe. Because, like, you know, even if you do track down Eric Riley and talk to him, it doesn't mean that he's not still telling a fib.
Oh, exactly. And I mean, that's the bottom line is, I mean, law enforcement is investigating. None of these stories that I've read, I saw, you know, Sergeant Celery from the whatever department saying, hey, yeah, we've got a lead on these undercover cops or this car driving around with this trunk open. So, you know, at some point maybe they're not believing it, or maybe there's not even a police report. I don't know.
Sergeant Celery, does he work with Captain Carrot?
It does, absolutely.
Sergeant Celery. Where do you come up with these things? Jack Nut, Sergeant Celery. Midwest raising there, I think, is what that is. All right, our listener spotlight each week. We take a listener and we say, hey, we're going to put a spotlight on you. And if you call our hotline, 813-448-1120, or you email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and you haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we'll send you something really cool. This comes from Everett Rice. He says, I was just wondering what goes into planning and running a tournament series. Heartland Poker Tour comes to St. Louis twice a year. Hollywood Casino has the Hollywood Poker Open, and 2013 was their first year in this area. And the World Series Circuit is coming back to another casino in our area. One problem is that all three of these series are scheduled to take place within a six-week period. This can't be good for business. Number one, everyday folks like me can only play maybe one or at most two. Number two, back-to-back-to-back series just drain a lot of the poker money out of the area. Also, it would seem like these series would offer special mini-series or more satellites throughout the year to get players more involved in playing their series. I'm looking for your valued insight into the workings and logistics of running a tournament series.
Wow, valued insight.
Yeah.
It really likes us.
I was thinking the same thing.
He's got a lot of, he might even give us a ride to the airport. Wow, I got a lot to say about this. Well, first of all, just in the very microscopic St. Louis part of this question, which I'll expand it more in a minute, but part of this is that when you have these branded tour series, sometimes you don't get to pick and choose when they come. You sign a contract and they say, hey, this is where we're coming. And that's exactly what happened with the circuit here. You know, there's an opening, the circuit event in Cleveland got canceled, opening in the schedule. They said, hey, Lumiere, do you want to run, have a host event? Yep, absolutely do. Here's the date. So it just happens to be popped into the middle of these. So otherwise it would be two. Now it's three. But all that being said, I think it's from someone who's, you know, trying our own fledgling tour here as well.
Right.
It's very difficult to find holes in the tournament schedule now. I mean, everybody's doing tournaments. And so, unfortunately, in most jurisdictions, you've got tournament after tournament after tournament. Now, they may not be high-profile ones like HPT and the Hollywood Poker Open and the Circuit, but it's, you know, people need to squeeze it into where they can. So that's a problem. But to Everett's bigger point, he's exactly right, and this is what a lot of poker room managers are worried about right now, is that no one has the money to play all of these events. Or I should say no one. Obviously, there's some people do, but the masses don't have
the money. The everyday players kind of thing.
Exactly. So, and they're going to do exactly what Everett does. They're going to choose one, if they're lucky, maybe two of these. So it's impossible for all three of these to be super successful because of that, unless they're bringing in a lot of people from out of town. And the problem with bringing a lot of people from out of town is there are tournaments everywhere close to where they live. So it's really hard to get them to travel now when they could just stay home and play tournaments. So, as he said, this can't be good for business. That's exactly right. It's somebody's going to lose, and in a lot of these cases now we're finding two of these three are losing, or all three of them are losing. And I don't really know what the solution is because people, you know, these rooms need to do these tournaments to keep things exciting. They would try to, in some places, they actually try to work together not to overlap or try to put some space, but that's, you know, again, you're at the mercy of what you're doing at that point. And it's just tough to make it work with that many tournaments. So you just got to hope that yours is the best.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if I'm going to play devil's advocate, I would say that the reason that they're doing this, and in the St. Louis area, it was because there's something popped up and some of a sudden we're going to jump on that because it's a big brand and, you know, we didn't know that we were going to be able to get the circuit back. But a lot of times they're doing this because they are thinking, hey, we're going to have a bunch of players coming to our area to play that series. They're already here. Let's capitalize on that and make them just extend their stay another week and come to our series. So
sure.
That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to, you know, piggyback or stand on the shoulders of other people who are, you know, more brave or courageous to hold a series in the first place. And so now that you've got the bodies there, you've got the money there, they're hoping to keep that money there a little bit longer, and then maybe the locals will win, you know, enough to stick around and then keep their bankrolls, you know, replenished from series to series. So I can see that side of it, but you're absolutely right. And not only are they the managers now you know, hoping that doesn't happen. They're actually finding out that it is happening.
Right.
You know, we can attest to that, that, you know, too many series in one place or in one area, absolutely, they can't afford those big buy-ins, or they can't afford to just keep playing. You know, the casual player will pick one series, but the guys who, you know, do it for a living or do it for a semi-living or whatever, if they have a bad run in the first series, they got to go back home and work the tables and build it back up again, because they're not going to, you know, be able to just keep entering $1,100 events, you know, or whatever, $1,200, $5,000, whatever they are, $1,600, and back-to-back-to-back like that. So it is difficult, and I'm thinking that that's what it is. It's not necessarily they're looking to screw you out of anything. They're just thinking, hey, we got all these players there with money. They're all coming to town already, or they're all gearing up for it already. Let's just keep the ball rolling, the momentum rolling, and have them just scoot across town to our series when their series is over, or when they bust out, you know, or something like that. And because, you know, a lot of times, I mean, how many times have you and I been around tournament poker covering it or playing in it or whatever, out of state or wherever, and somebody's running terrible and they get knocked out of a big event on a day one, they're on the phone immediately. How can I get to the EPT? How can I get to, yeah, you know, they're trying to get to another event immediately. So this is another way of combating them leaving the area to go play another tournament series because they're hungry for redemption. So I totally see Everett's side of it. I just kind of see the other side too.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the satellites, and I think this is one of the most interesting things to me is that, you know, we've talked to a lot of poker managers about doing satellites, not only for our tour events, but for our cruises. And more than half, I would say, have said, you know what, Scott, satellites do not work in our room.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it's for. It doesn't matter if it's the World Series of Poker, which usually works everywhere. Our players just don't get satellites. They don't like them. They want the instant gratification of getting something. They don't want to play for something to win a chance to play for something else. And if we can't get people to play in them, then we're not going to offer them. And, you know, that hurts people like Everett and me and others that do want the satellites. I do want the chance to get into a bigger event or to win a cruise really cheaply. But from the operational standpoint, I get it. I mean, you're not going to commit the dealers and the time and the tables for something that's going to get 5, 6 people or 12, whatever it is, that doesn't really work. So it's frustrating for me because I don't get it, because, you know, I grew up playing online. I mean, in my poker career, not obviously when I was a kid, but grew up, and I love playing satellites. I love trying to satellite myself into the weekly horse tournament or whatever it was, because that was great.
Yeah.
But apparently, in lots and lots of places, people just don't like satellites. So,
and that could be another, yeah, and that's another reason why these bankrolls can't sustain these things, because they're not trying to get in on the cheap. They're just either buying in directly, you know what I mean, or they're buying into other tournaments that cost too much, you know, smaller tournaments, but too many of them, and they're not, you know, they're not trying to get in for what's affordable to them, and that could be a reason why they can't make all three series. So they really need to, the thinking needs to change on both sides, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But okay, call the floor. You find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the proper ruling should have been. Well, you can listen to Scott sneeze, or you can hit the mute button. Email us at podcast@anyupmagazine.com, and we'll have our veteran poker room manager, Jody Russell, tell you how he would have ruled. This week's sponsor is J-Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Any Up. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. This comes from Wayne Jolly. He's a happy fellow. He says, in a no-limit hold'em home game, we have action on streets. On the river, the button bets, and the big blind is pondering his decision. He looks at his cards again and says, I have three cards. The third card was stuck to one of the other two, and he had not seen it until now. For simplicity's sake, we declared that the big blind's holdings were irrelevant to the ruling, and we ruled a misdeal with all the chips to be returned. Was that the correct decision, considering there was a substantial amount of action in the hand?
All right, here's what Jody says. He says, every player is responsible to protect their hand and their right to win the pot. This includes being aware of not having a proper hand on the initial deal and bringing that to the attention of the dealer and the other players right away. In a public card room, this hand would be ruled dead and the player would lose their right to any portion of the pot. In public card rooms, we have people playing together who do not know each other well. There is a concern of integrity. Consider these possibilities. A. The player with three cards could be trying to reintroduce a card they kept out from a prior hand. They were going to sneak it back to the deck, but now they are about to have a showdown and everybody is looking at them. B. He was dealt all three cards in the initial deal, noticed it immediately, and was waiting to see which two cards to play with intentions of hiding the insignificant card at showdown. Upon realizing he couldn't win the pot with his hand, he declares he has a fouled hand on the river in hopes of getting his money back from the pot because he has seen this decision before. C. This was an honest mistake, and there is no foul play involved. Because the scenario is similar to A and B, we have to kill the hand so everyone at the table knows the integrity of the game is being maintained. Imagine this happening at your table in a room where you've never played before. It's you and a local player heads up. You have the nut straight. The pot is huge. But wait, he has just discovered a third card in his hand. Oh well, we're going to give it back his money and missteal the hand. You, what the? Dealer, floor decision. Floor person, sir, we don't tolerate that type of language. Please stop or we have to ask you to leave. Dealer, split the pot. Now imagine what happened, that happening more than once in the same game. At some point, none of the players would trust the integrity of the game. Home games are often more relaxed and relaxed because everyone knows each other and or the stakes are very low. In those instances, this situation could be handled the way you described, but I wouldn't recommend it even then.
Yeah, it all comes down to trust in your home game. You know, if they're your friends and you've been with them for years and you trust them, yeah, okay, let's just redo the hand or something. But, you know, if it's something like, hey, that guy's brand new to the game, I'm sorry, but it's just not my fault. Here are the rules and here are the Robert's rules to show it or whatever, you know, then you got to say, hey, you got to be more careful or something. But if we're all friends, we've been together for a long time, then you got to say, all right, let's not ruin our friendship or ruin our game over a $12 pot. You know, let's just do what we think is fair.
Yeah, this is another one of those scenarios where I think I can understand our listeners and players being upset with what Jody's saying, you know, hey, I honestly didn't know I had three cards. I mean, we've seen that particularly in home games, you know, you're using a worn-out deck because you haven't gone to ClassicPlayingCards.com and bought new ones from J Design yet. And so those cards tend to stick together, and I can totally see this happening. And so I could see players saying, you know what, I didn't realize it. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Try to peel back each card each time to make sure. At the end of the day, it's an unfortunate situation, but you're the one that's caught holding the unfortunate situation, and that's life. I like to, you know, it sucks, but that's life. So I would like to think that this kind of thing doesn't happen very often everywhere, and if it does happen in your home game a lot, then yes, definitely buy a new deck of cards.
Yeah, new cards.
So you can avoid it from happening, but I can't imagine this is going to happen very often in most card rooms, so I don't think it's a scenario that you're going to see very often. But bottom line, as a player, you got to do everything you can in your power to protect your hand, as Jody said. Doesn't mean that you're always in the wrong, but as long as you're doing everything you possibly can, far fewer of these decisions are going to go against you.
Right, I mean, and there's a certain amount of responsibility. I mean, look at me in our home game where you weren't playing. I thought we were playing PLO 8, and we weren't. And it's my responsibility to have remembered what game we were playing. It was so obvious when I called the final bet and showed the low and had no high at all that I thought we were going PLO 8. They didn't give me back my $25. You know what I mean? They said, hey, sorry. You know, and I understood that, and I wasn't going to get mad and walk out. It's my friends in my home game. I made the mistake. I need to own up to it. You know, I was pissed, and if they said, hey, Chris, you're right, here's your money back, I would have taken it because it was an honest mistake, but they didn't. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, I'm so stupid. That was stupid of me, and I can't believe we weren't playing that game. But hey, you gotta own up to your responsibilities too. So if everyone's in agreement to give the guy his money back because he had three cards, that's fine. But if some people are saying, you know what, dude, I'm sorry, you need to check your cards, then I think you need to. But it seems like it was a consensus here, so
yeah,
you know. I don't know. I think Jody is starting to get some humor in his responses. I kind of like that.
I like it.
Absolutely. That was a really nice, detailed response. That was really cool. That's why it's one of the best segments, not only on our show, but in the magazine. Hey, we got a brand new O'Malley's Move this week. I'm looking forward to this one because it finally gets back to No Limit Hold'em. Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2 No Limit Hold'em cash game. We're playing with some action junkies today, but they love to float. Furthermore, when they do float, they tend to play a bit timidly. We're up about $100 as we sit with a round three. It's a full table. The under-the-gun folds, plus one folds, plus two folds. The MP raises it to $8. MP1 folds, hijack folds, cutoff folds, and we're on the button with the King of Clubs, Queen of Hearts. Now, this MP is a good player, but is impatient and extremely streaky. He's about even with 200 sitting in front of him. The problem is, we've seen him raise preflop with big hands as well as suited connectors and suited gappers. We're not exactly sure where we stand here, so we go in with a plan. We're going to call, and since we have position, proceed with caution. Basically, we're going to play the player. The blinds fold, and with about $20 in the pot, the flop comes the ace of spades, nine of hearts, tray of clubs. A total miss. But our player checks. This check stinks, especially since this guy loves to trap. But we really don't think that's what he's doing here. Nevertheless, we proceed with caution and check. The turn is the King of Spades, and once again, our opponent checks. Okay, there's no way an ace or better is checking this turn. We make it $15 to go. The MP wastes little time in calling. The river is the 10 of diamonds. All of a sudden, the MP wakes up and makes a $35 bet into this $50 pot. What's our move?
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the app today by visiting the iTunes store. And it comes from our old friend, BitGuru. And he sent in a photo of his Hand of the Week.
Oh, so I don't have... I'm in another town over here.
Detailed descriptions on it, so I'm going to do my best here to try to solve this as I go. But real quickly, he said a few days ago he decided to put $25 on Carbon Poker for real money games. As I think, as most of us know, we're not going to put a ton of money on online poker anymore.
Right.
But, you know, hey, it's entertainment at this point. And he says he's played a bunch of dollar single table sit and goes with 100% cash rate.
Brag.
But he goes on to say, I doubt I'll be able to keep that. But he says he's still getting used to software. He might be moving way up. Anyhow, he's having a lot of fun with them. And so we ended up with, I guess it's a quasi hand of the week situation here, because it's a sit and go, which I miss sit and go so much.
I think we heard that earlier in the show that you missed.
Yeah, I just love playing them on the cruise ship now, because that's the only time I get to play them.
Right.
Because there's so much more strategy involved in chip stacks and how many people are left than in a normal multi-table tournament when you've got a huge field to get through. And so part of the situation here is... they're on the bubble here. Four players left. Three spots will pay. And our hero, BitGuru, and the villain have the big stacks at the in this hand with squiggly 4,000. And our hero has them covered by a few hundred. The other two players have squiggly 1,000.
Okay.
And these are the kind of situations that I look for in a sit-and-go, because if I'm one of the two big stacks, I'm going to wait for... I'm not going to wait necessarily, but I want to... I'm not going to be swinging around being the table sheriff here and trying to knock these guys out. I'm going to let the cards play, because these guys both have squiggly 1,000. They're the ones that are desperate. Let them make the mistake, and then I'll catch them in the mistake.
Yeah.
And because at that point, once one is out, you're in the money, and then you can get a little bit more aggressive with the last guy.
But, yeah.
All right, so let me get the photo loaded here. All right, so we are at the 60. Let's see, I guess it's 122.40, or blinds are 61.20. Let's say that.
Okay.
At this point, and the two short stacks fold, and our hero is in the small blind with queen six.
Okay. Fold. Fold. Thanks for listening to the show this week. I mean, I don't know what to think here. I'm sort of the kind of person that doesn't defend a small blind if it's not even remotely close to being a decent hand.
Yeah.
And I just say, you know what? Here, take the walk and let's move on. I have the button. You know, I just don't see any reason to play this hand. I'm the big stack. Why get involved with a hand against a big stack with queen six for no reason when in another second I'm going to be on the button?
On the button, yeah.
And really, I mean, it's so hard sometimes to do these hands because I'm getting put in situations I would never be in, you know, almost never. And I mean, unless I knew that the big blind was super tight and would fold to a raise, you know, because then I'm out of position the whole way if he calls, and then I'm screwed because I got queen six. So, I mean, really, I would just fold this hand unless I knew more about that player. I just let it go.
Yeah, part of the problem here is that you're out of position against the big stack.
Yeah.
Forever here at this point. So, you know, you're going to have to. What sucks here is folding the small blind consistently to him is tough to do, but that's just where you are at the table. But I really don't see any reason to get involved in this. Interestingly enough, when I went to Proof the Pages last night, we played a multi-table tournament. Started pretty slow. We started four-handed at a table. And, you know, the new TDA rules, they don't deal with dead stacks. So it was like a four-handed table at that point.
Right.
And that forces you, obviously, to open up your ranges because you can't just play tight and keep folding and let somebody else steal the blinds all the time. But at the same time, you have to be responsible about it. I mean, we were starting with 15,000 in units, so you, on very first hand of the tournament, there was an all-in and a call.
Oh, no way.
And that's just ridiculous. I mean, it ended up being the guy flopped the nut flush, and then the other guy rivered a full house on him. So, I mean, they both have legitimate hands, but, you know, at 25-50, you should not be getting it all in. You
right.
know, that's just got a lot of play left, right?
Right.
And so here, it's the same situation. Four-handed, I'm not so worried about the blind creep here, particularly because we had, 4,000 in units?
Yeah.
So I'm giving up 60 to this guy? No big deal. I mean, there's no reason to get involved with a bad hand here. We're one away from the money, so the other two guys are pretty desperate, as we said. I mean, each of them have less than 10 big blinds, so they're going to have to make a move very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Let them make the mistake. And hopefully we're the one that catches him the mistake and it's the beneficiary. But if not, at least we're getting the money. Getting involved with queen six here, even if it was one of the short stacks in the big blind, I'm not going to play this hand. I'm not going to, because at that point, your problem in a sit and go is you don't want to double up one of the small stacks.
Exactly. Exactly. They're two doubles away from you being out and them being the chip leader. You know, that's just crazy to me. I just don't even look. I look at the six, I look at the queen, I go, yep, see ya. Give me the button.
Yeah.
And move on. And, you know, like, and that, this is a good point you made, too, that not only are you one away from the money, but it's the other big stack in this hand. You never get involved with the other big stack when you're on, you know, on the bubble with two short stacks at the table in a sit and go, and they have less than 10, and you have, like, almost 30. You know, it's just crazy.
I tell you, as a short stack, I love that back when I used to play sit and goes online. Watch the two big stacks get tangled up.
Of course, absolutely.
Because it's ridiculous for either one of them, unless it's like ace-ace and king-king or something crazy like that,
right.
You know, cooler hand. But otherwise, I just every time I saw that, I'm like, what are you guys doing? I'm sitting here, I'm like on fumes.
Yeah.
And you guys are battling each other? You don't get any extra points for having 8,000 units here, you know? It's going to be a better spot to win, but, you know, at this point, it's you're still going to be a good shot to win, even if you just wait for one of the small stacks to go out to the other guy.
Right.
You know, it's only an extra 1,000 at that point. So, all right. Well, our hero decides to call, which, you know, I'm not going to – I love Big Rude to death, and he knows this. Not going to pound on him too much more. But, you know, if you're going to play this hand, I think you got to play for a raise, don't you?
Exactly. What are you calling for? Is it you hope that you outflop him now? If you're going to play it, you're not playing it to disguise the strength of your queen six. So, no, you're absolutely right. I think you'd have to play it for a raise.
Yeah, the goal here is just to pick up the blinds, and because the blinds come around so quickly, you want to, you know, yeah, you want to pick up the blinds enough to get a free look at the next round.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go to war with a guy with this queen six, because the problem with, and I saw this in this tournament last night, it was mind boggling because it was $200 buy-in tournament. You shouldn't really see that in that, but people just completing the small blind with everybody else folded beforehand. The exact same situation here. All you're doing is letting the guy with seven deuce and the big blind get a monster flop on you that you're not going
to
believe them.
Right, and you're giving them more chips to just fold eventually. You know what I mean? Why not just give them half the bet and move on?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we both disagree with that, so that's good. We agree again. This is
not good. We'll find a way to disagree at some point here. Okay. All right, so the big blind checks, which I also think is interesting. I mean, in the scenario where the sit and go, small blind's just going to limp in, I guess I could be, I think it might be a little fishy, but I want to say, you limping? What are you limping for? I might play back at him and just to see whether he really does have a big hand or not. If he just calls my raise, then I know he's just playing around, and I'll take control of the hand, and if he re-raises me, then all right, then I probably save myself some money because I'm not going to get over-involved with him on the rest of the hand.
Well, if I'm being completely honest, half the time I'm always like, yes, I'll take a free flop. Run him. So I can see the proper way to do it is probably to raise and steal that 120 back, but there is the opportunity for him to be slow playing something, and then they trap us, and you know it's a big
stack.
Yeah,
but wouldn't you want to poke the bear right now?
I don't know. They're big stack against big stack for the same reasons we were saying fold to queen six. This is another reason why I'm saying don't just raise.
Well, I guess the other strategy is I would just check here if I'm waving the white flag on the hand and just hoping I hit a massive flop.
Yeah.
And if not, then that's fine. That I can defend. But you know, if you're going to get active on this hand on a weak flop, then I think you need to raise here and find out what you're up against.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're just fine saying, hey, I'm going to flop big or go home, then yeah, sure, check and save the money and let that guy take your big blind.
Right.
All right, so he checks, and the flop comes down, queen of hearts, queen of diamonds, ten of spades. And of course, we're first act.
Yeah. Well, we didn't take any initiative in this hand, so betting out now, you know, typically he didn't hit this flop. It is a situation/hand of the week, so I expect some sort of problem with this, but typically he wouldn't hit this flop. So if I bet out and he's going to have, like, you know, 5-8, he's just going to fold because he checked. So I'm kind of hoping I want him to catch up a little bit or try to steal it from me. So, I'm setting myself up for a disaster here because it's the end of the week. So, but I would probably check it, and I would take my time checking it. I wouldn't check it instantly because usually that's an indication that you've hit it.
It's online, so you don't have a lot of time.
Oh, that's right, it's online. Well, I can't relate to that. I have to play it live in my head. I don't know what it's like online anymore. But yeah, I would take some time before I hit check then online. How's that?
All right, very good. I could go two different ways on here. You're right. If you come out here strong, it's most likely he's missed the slob. He's just going to fold. You're going to get no value out of it. I kind of look at this. I look at almost my whole tournament, but particularly when we get down to this point, as setting up people for other moves. So I'm going to want to be able to bet out on flops that I completely miss in this situation next hand or the hand after it. And if I don't hear, but I do then I start to get a little bit predictable. So I might try to be consistent and just bet out here again. And, you know, if all I get is the money is in the pot, that's great because I should have never been in this hand anyhow, right? Mm-hmm. And if I get raised, great, because I got to think I had the best hand here right now. If I get called, fine too. But I'm a little worried about slow playing it. It could get trapped. Maybe it's just because I slow played flop trips last night and got brutalized. So now geez. I'm more into being aggressive on it. But I think it depends on what kind of player. If you want to be consistent in your betting, not just on the streets and everything, but at this point when people are really paying attention to you. Because remember, when you start a sit and go with 9 people or 10 people, it's hard to keep track of how everyone's playing. You know, the really good players do, but most people don't. When you're down to four-handed, everybody's paying attention to exactly what you're doing. Now, obviously, they think that you got a couple desperate players here, so maybe no one's playing their normal poker game. But I'm really trying to set people up at this point. So I think I'm just going to keep the pressure on because I would bet out on this regardless of what it was in general. And I would take down the pot now if that's what's going to happen.
Hmm. Okay, well, I'll take that into consideration next time we're in a four-handed sit and go. I mean, I like your line of thinking a little bit with the setting them up later, but generally it's sort of done in reverse of what you're saying. To me, I would think. You know, you bet out when it's crap. You bet out when it's crap. Then he's finally thinking, this guy bets out all the time. He must not always have it. And then when you have it, you bet out. And then you have the three queens, and he's screwed.
Well, but yeah, it works out if I've been doing that for the last four or five hands.
Right.
Obviously, we're coming into this at this point, so we don't know. And so it's a problem if I'm starting it now.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Right. I don't want to start with the big
that's
hand.
That's the setup, is that eventually he'll play back at me when I have the goods. But the other thing is, too, remember how many times we missed the flop, particularly four-handed.
Yeah.
So the more times I'm being aggressive and betting out and getting somebody to fold because they don't want to play back at me, the more blinds I pick up. And particularly, again, this is more of a sit-and-go strategy, I think. You know, not so much against the chip leader, which is who we're playing against now, so I'm not trying to get away from the hand of the week. But these short stacks, you know, they're not going to commit their stacks unless they have something. So this is your opportunity when you're Big Guru and the other guy to keep chiseling away at these guys and picking up their blinds and waiting for them to get desperate and make a bad move. So if I keep betting out, you know, they're not going to – there's no fold equity when they shove over the top with me with absolutely nothing. So, you know, three out of four flops are going to miss, and three out of four flops I'm going to get their blinds and make them even all the more desperate. So I know I'm not playing against the short stack right now, but I'm setting up the whole table for how I play this.
I think it's two out of three flops, but I don't want anybody writing in and yelling at you. But
no, five out of six, whatever it is, it doesn't matter.
Four out of six.
You're right.
Two out of three.
Well, it's four-handed, so it changes it, right?
I don't think so. I just didn't want anybody yelling at you, that's all.
Oh, no, I always like people yelling at me. Right. But the general point you get.
No, I absolutely get your point. I get your point. But for me, I think I'm going to take a chance to slow play it this time.
Okay. All right, so that's what our hero did, and it is checked behind.
Double-checked.
So free card, and that free card is the Ace of Spades.
Of course,
so aboard now, Queen of Hearts, Queen of Diamonds, Ten of Spades, Ace of Spades. Personally, I kind of like this card because it makes it more likely that he might have had an ace, and I'll get some action out of him now. Although I wouldn't be able to understand why he wouldn't re-raise me with an ace pre-flop, so I guess I should take that back.
Would he re-raise you with Ace Deuce? Or ace 5 or ace 6?
Four-handed in a situation when a small blind limps to me, yes, absolutely. I was ready to raise with anything.
Would he re-raise you with King Jack?
I would, yes.
Okay, so then I hate the card if he would raise us with...
Well, that's true, too, yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what he would do.
But he didn't raise us. So.
He didn't raise us, no. So in other words, you're thinking that an ace in his hand or King Jack in his hand is unlikely.
It's unlikely just by the way he played it.
Okay, cool.
Doesn't mean I'm going to get overconfident here, but
no, I'm just wondering if straight
draws are pretty darn strong.
Yeah.
And a four-handed.
Well, now you got to bet, right? I mean, he showed weakness.
Yeah, you can't wait at this point.
And you're hoping he does have a naked ace and just wasn't particularly proud of that ace before.
To go back a while, I like this card. That's exactly why, because I feel like I have to bet out now, and the fact that the ace is there, you know, might help me represent that I have the ace, and maybe he's got. Maybe he's drawn to something else that's better. Or I don't know. I guess I don't really care for him drawing.
And if he's thinking like you're thinking, if you bet the ace, he would say, if you had an ace, you would have raised, right? You would have raised preflop. So
exactly.
You don't have an ace, so my 10 is good.
That's
so he's going to call your bet or even raise you. So I like the bet here.
Yep. All right. Our hero checks.
Oh, man. He could have any random jack in his hand, and then you can let him complete a straight on the end, or any random king, and then you're giving him a free card to make a straight, and you don't get value for your three queens.
There's a lot of danger here, because now with the straight draw, you got the flush draws as well, too. I mean, he could have easily limped in with seven deuce of spades, right?
Yeah, because he was big blind, didn't even limp, he just checked.
Yeah, exactly,
absolutely.
And you gave him two free cards, so...
I don't like that.
That's a lot of danger in checking here, I think. And the danger is magnified when it's checked behind.
Yeah, that's terrible.
So our river is the Eight of Clubs. So our final board is Queen of Hearts, Queen of Diamonds, Ten of Spades, Ace of Spades, Eight of Clubs. And it is on us.
I mean, there's 100, it's like 240 in the pot. How could this be bad? How could this end up bad? I mean... You have $4,000. There's 240 in the pot. What's the worst that could happen? So bet half the pot and see if he calls. If he raises you, just call him because you don't know what happened. Jack 9 is a very plausible check behind big blind hand. You know, so if he's got a bigger hand than you now, you've let him catch up and it's your own fault. So let's just put a little bet out there, see if our three queens are good. If he just calls, you know you're good. And if he raises, then you just, as long as it's not 4,000,
right?
You know, call and say, oh, I played it kind of silly here. I shouldn't have done this. So I'm just going to bet half the pot.
All right. That's almost what our guy did. Our hero bets 160. And he is raised, min-raised, 320.
Call. Call, move on to the next hand, give me the button.
Yeah, and I think that's the absolute best advice there at this point, because we just don't have any idea where we are, right?
Right.
And I think we let ourselves get sucked into the fact that we just have this monster unbeatable hand. And you're right, it's just, it's not now. Because you're right, the Jack-9 is very possible. And really, what are we going to try to get at this point? I mean, I guess the chip leader, let's just move on to the next hand and not get too cute, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, if it was the six of clubs on the end, then it's like, all right, well, we got the boat. We can, you know, obviously play back again because we're not worried about losing everything, because
sure,
if he had ace-queen or queen-ten, maybe queen-ten, he would have checked behind, but I doubt it. But, you know, he might have, I don't think he would have checked behind on the ace if he had a boat or three of a kind like us. I think that would be a poor move on his part. So it doesn't feel like he has a queen. It feels like he has a straight now.
Yeah. All right. Well, our hero raises the 960.
No, no.
And immediately is raised all in.
Oh, why open the betting again? No, I can't agree with any of that.
Yeah, kids, this is a lesson in the hand, and I think BitGuru knows it.
Wow, you reopened the betting. And he min-raised you, too, so that's right there telling you something, you know, before. So, all right, well, I'm folding. I really am. I'm folding three queens on this. I really am. I'm in the money if one short stack goes out. Why would I risk going out of this event and letting the two short stacks get in over misplaying a hand this poorly, you know? And I don't mean that as a... I'm just saying, as if I had played it this way, you know what I mean? I'm not saying that BitGuru played it that poorly, but
right,
I would have definitely bet this a lot earlier and on the turn at least. I have to fold. You?
Well, yeah. Again, it comes down to sit and go strategy here. We're one win from money, and all those people out there screaming, Scott, I know I'm playing for the win, not the cash. I get it, but your chances of winning really are not that much better by knocking this guy out here versus the risk of being absolutely crippled. I mean, you're going to be down to a couple $100 at this point.
Yeah.
And then you're all in right away with two short stacks or 1,000 that are going to put it on lockdown at this point and just wait for you to make a move. And that's the real problem here. It's not going for the win. It's just an understanding the economics of a sit and go. And so at this point, you fold here. You've put, what, about a little bit more than 1,000, $1,100 in this pot. You still got 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
The guy you're folding to now has got a little bit more than 5,000. That's really not that big a deal in a sit and go when you think about it. And the other two short stacks are still at 1,000. And they're still desperate at that point.
Right.
And if you, again, go back to what I was saying, is waiting for them to make a mistake and hope you're the beneficiary. If you're the beneficiary of it, you're back at 4,000. And now it's 5,000, 4,000, 1,000.
Yep. Yep. And here's the deal. You made a really good point. When people say to you, but Scott, I want to win and not play for the money. I want to play for the win. Say, okay, well, let's say we do knock this guy out. And we have 8,000. They have 1,000 and 1,000. You're in the money. Now you're in the money. The two short stacks are going to be like, hey, we're in the money. Who cares now? Let's just shove. They both shove. They have one winner, and you didn't get into the hand. You have 8,000. Now they have 2,000. They get it all in with you one time. They have 4,000. You have 6,000 if they lose. And now you're basically even with this person. And there's no guarantee you're still going to win because you happen to have 8,000 chips in a three-handed sit-and-go. So, really, it's about getting into the money and then exposing the weakness. It's not about taking out the massive chip leader on a borderline call here and then risking the chance of even making money or having that chance to win. You need to get in there first and then win. You can't win on the first hand of a tournament. You know what I mean? Same kind of situation there.
At this point in the tournament. Now, to the rest of the tournament, yeah, I'm trying to play to win at that point.
Right.
But once it gets down to this point, then you got to start analyzing everything. And at this point, this is just, it's foolish here to call us at this point. Particularly when you, I mean, just in general, if it wasn't the sit-and-go scenario, just as you pointed out, the guy min-raised us. We raised him, and now he's all in. What does that tell you right there?
Exactly. You're not going to win with three queens, terrible kicker, you know? I mean, it's
you gotta hope
possible.
At this point he has queen five, queen four, queen trace, something like that.
All
which
the way
are,
up to
queen all nine. Possibilities,
yeah.
Right? It's just not worth it at this point, you know. Even if you think you really have a lock on the hand, it's just that he's put too much pressure on you.
Yep, exactly. And I think he's thinking the same thing. I think he's thinking like us, the opponent. You know, I wouldn't put my entire tournament on the line for a bluff here. There's no reason to. So really, all you're going to catch is a bluff here. And it's why risk your entire tournament on hoping to catch a bluff? So yeah. I'd let it go. What does he do?
He calls.
Oh.
And we show our queen of spades, six of diamonds. Our opponent shows queen of clubs, ten of clubs.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And I was going to ask that hand, too. I did mention before that it might be a hand they would just check behind with. Would you have raised with queen 10 preflop when it got limp to you like that?
Well, again, that's what I said. I would raise with a lot of hands there just because I don't understand what he's limping with.
Right.
You know, I don't really... It's interesting because I'm advocating not getting into a battle with the other chip stack from the small blind, but I'm not really advocating getting into a battle with the other from the big blind, but if he's going to limp, I want to know whether he's just hoping that he's limping to hope to hit a big hand and stack me and go on to crush the other people, or if he has a big hand, he's trying to be pretty sneaky. But queen 10 suited's a pretty strong hand four-handed anyhow. So at this point, I'm going to put in a raise and find out. Because, again, I've got enough chips here. This is what's really – I mean, this is a fascinating sit-and-go strategy hand, I think, because we're both around 4,000 here. Blinds are only 120 at this point. So let's say I raise it to 300.
Mm-hmm.
That's 3,700. If he plays back at me and re-raises, I can lay it down. I'm still at 3,700.
Yeah.
It's not hurting me.
Yeah.
It's really not hurting me. Now, if I keep doing that, then it's going to keep hurting me. But you make that adjustment later on. But right now, that 300 is not that big a deal to me. And if I can show him that he can't limp in on me, and then maybe I'll pick up a couple blinds more down the road where he's not going to be as aggressive, or he's not going to be so loose on limping in. Or he's going to force him to raise on me, which is going to allow me to choose better hands at that point, too. It's $300 well spent to me, you know, because
yeah.
I think I get a good chance of winning it. And if I don't, then it's fine. I can let it go. I still got 3,700. I still got two guys that have less than 10 big blinds that are desperate. And really, at this situation, think about it, too. Neither one of those two short stacks wants to go out now.
Right.
So both of them are going to be playing a waiting game, I think, if they're playing it right, I think. You know, they're not going to want to get blinded out, but they're going to want to hope the other guy gets a strong enough hand that he feels like he has to go in, but it's not strong enough to win with, and gets knocked out, and then he can play more aggressively after that. So I would rather not go against the other big stack here, but, you know, at this point, the other guys are going to find a way to get out on their own here. So if I can make small pots against the other guy, that's fine. And if not, we're going to let these other two guys kind of blind themselves out.
Here's the good question is that he said he was cashing 100%, but did he cash in this one now that
he did, actually.
He so
said
he did survive.
He did hang on for third place in this. So
wow.
Yeah, I guess it kind of worked out. I think he probably had a good chance of winning this had he not overcommitted his chips here.
Or at the very least second.
And we'll never know. But at least he got the cash, so he can go on. So, you know, again, it's one of these lessons that it's just like a bad hand. You make a bad hand, you're like, oh, my gosh, I just really misread that, and I shouldn't have bet like that. And then you're like, all right, I put myself on lockdown. I'm going to be really focused on the next hand. So if after this, he's like, whew, at least I got third. I made some money. And you don't worry about the money that you lost on this, the potential money that you could have won on this hand, this tournament, and go back and play the next one a little stronger, then it's a good tournament.
Right, you just learn from it and move on. You know, that's definitely a situation where there were so many ways that we would have played this differently and would not have cost us, you know, first or second place on it the way we played it. So, because even if you did bet out with that queen, you're probably going broke. You know, no matter what, if you had bet out on
exactly.
the flop, you were going
yeah.
broke. But a pre-flop, if you had raised significantly, he may have folded, or if you had folded like I was going to do. None of this happens. So,
Really,
you got to think about why you're playing your hand. Why limp there with that hand? Just for this one miracle? Well, look what happened.
Yeah.
Ended up backfiring. So, Big Guru, thanks for letting us have some fun at your expense. Appreciate it. All right, I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
I am recording all this, by the way, so...